I do not remember a time when I was not being thrown into the back of, you know, some old vehicle and driven to a national park and waking up in the morning and being expected from a very young age to then walk somewhere. That was just part of the experience of growing up in my family, and I don't think I ever let go of it.
The poet Catherine Coles walks a lot, and usually outside, though she does have a treadmill at home that her husband Chris helped her rig up for working, and it's positioned facing a big window.
If you imagine a shoebox in which the long parts of the box are floor-to-ceiling glass, that's the sort of situation. I'm actually sitting right next to that treadmill right now, looking out on that view.
And it's a killer view. Looks out over the treetops into a canyon in Salt Lake. And the way she has the treadmill set up, it's like she's always walking toward the edge of a cliff that never arrives.
There's a sense in which, for me, engaging the body allows the mind to do things that it doesn't otherwise do. It releases, or it has the potential to release the mind from its least productive obsessions and set it free into something else. Chris installed a mount for my laptop on the treadmill, and over time, I have learned to type at 4 miles per hour and read at 7, if the reading is easy. I can compose syllabi while walking, or grade papers, or mark up dissertations, or answer the constant stream of anxious emails from students. As you might guess, I don't get carsick either, thank goodness, or airsick, or seasick. But when I do raise my eyes from the screen and cast my gaze beyond the glass, I move not only out of my room, familiar and disorganized for my sole convenience, but out of myself. The canyon, along with its bird population, changes season by season. The screech owls that return to our nesting box in the fall will fledge chicks by June and scatter into summer darkness. The snow covering everything now in its great blankness will give way to melt and detail, then to buds and leaves that will eventually flame and fall, to grasses that will emerge in soft green, then go gold and dry to tinder as fire season arrives. Changes occur not only seasonally, hour by hour, even moment by moment. The light that defines this landscape shifts and slants, brightens and shadows, drags its bright tail across the mountains. Every time I follow my eyes outward, then, I am transported, not only out of my own head, which can forget that its very machinations make it alien to itself, but also into a place made constantly new by the turn of the planet. An Adrienne Rich poem about the astronomer Carolyn Herschel. She describes looking through the telescope in the same way as a kind of projection of the self out into space, out into the beyond. And this is just a reversal, I think, of the way that we usually imagine or consider the visual system as bringing the world in and sort of tucking it into our brain or into our heads or whatever. It also does the other thing, right? It projects us outward, imaginatively, and in some ways literally outward into the world. And it's just, I think, enhanced kind of extravagantly by the sensation of walking into this place where literally, if I were moving forward, I would be moving forward into the treetops. I would no longer have my feet on the ground at that point.
The latest book from Catherine Coles, a collection of lyric essays, is always on the move. The book travels like she travels, usually on foot, and she's walked all over the world. That sense of movement is important in the way she writes. As she puts it in one of the essays, she travels out as she travels into herself.
On my treadmill, looking out, I would never know that just as the canyon falls away before me, behind me, unrolling in the other direction from the top of the foothill at the top of my drive, lies a city covered today in snow. Downtown, less than 2 miles away, the university, 3. I live exactly on the interface, on the edge of a neighborhood that plummets on one side into wilderness, on the other into an urban heart. This is my own city, dusty, western, with wide streets and low buildings. I know it so well, I forget to see it. Even on my treadmill, on the streets of Jakarta or London, on a glacier in Antarctica, forgetting it, I keep it in mind. It lives in me and beyond me. Like every other city, it remains a mystery.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Catherine Coles is with us today, talking about her book. It's called The Stranger I Become, on walking, looking, and writing. It's a collection of lyric essays. It's part memoir with stories, but it's more poetry than prose, really. And that's where we began the conversation, with the difference between the two.
I don't want to be either too reductive or too geeky about this, right?
So yes.
the difference between poetry and prose has to do with the fact that poetry, by and large, we think of as coming to us in lines, which is a certain way of marking time. And an essay we think of as coming to us in sentences, which is a different way of marking time. But I think that a lyric essay, which is what these are, really does have more in common with poetry in spite of that question of timing. And that really has to do with how you think about cause and effect as organizing the passage of time, as opposed to if we would think of narrative prose as being because of this, then this. In a poem, you would think of saying this and this and this, so that we're not trying to string things out in a kind of cause-effect relationship, but more to give the experience of everything happening at the same time. And over and over again.
I wanted to ask you about how you're thinking about and writing about the mind. Because you say in the essay collection that walking reminds me, re-minds me. Explain what you mean and how you see the mind. For you, it's sort of a collection of your senses. What do you mean by mind?
I think that we do ourselves and our experience a disservice if we think of the mind as living only in the brain, in the head. And the literal construction of the visual system really puts the lie to this, because technically the retinal material in the eye is actually made of neural matter. It's the brain literally reaching out into the eye in order to encounter the world. And likewise, as images are coming into the eye and being processed, they're being shuttled back into the brain through the visual pathways. And they're being constructed in the brain. The image that I am seeing right now, looking out my window, exists only in my brain as it is constructed there through the neural impulses that are coming in. And if that's true, and it is true, then the same thing is true of the auditory systems. Those are all processing, they're bringing in impulses, but processing. And likewise, all of the neural networks that reach from the brain through the body and make up the senses, right? This is a back and forth communication.
Yeah.
And so we really do ourselves a disservice not to remember that the mind is really a full body experience. And beyond that, it also comprises memory, expectation, desire. And so one of the reasons that walking is so good for thinking is that it causes the neurons to fire in a full body kind of way.
Yeah. Let's talk about looking. Another one of the themes you work through in the book, because you've described the book as a meditation on perception. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you said is that there's this space, you describe it as this liminal space that interests you between, I don't know, Kate, if I have this right, between your internal self and your external self. Is that right?
Well, between the internal self and the world out there.
Yeah.
Right. And I like that you said it, that that's the external self, because it is only for us what we perceive. And this is not to say that I don't believe it exists. I absolutely do believe that it exists and that we can, through science and perception, understand it and know it. But I'm also very cognizant of the fact that the world out there for me is mediated by my senses, and again, by my memory, by my experience, by my reading, right, by all of these other things. And it's that sort of in-between space where all of that processing takes place that is really fascinating to me. And it takes place for scientists too. It's not only poets, right, who are inflecting and repurposing that external world all the time.
One of the things you mentioned early on in one of the essays is that when you were still a young poet and you were trying to develop your voice, and at first you tried, as you say, to work toward unity. Mm-hmm. Explain what you were going through. Explain this evolution. It's really interesting to me, because at first you had this idea that a poem had to be only about one thing. And it seemed like you kind of ditched the idea of having to find some sort of unity. Take me through this, if you would.
Yeah, and I actually think that that's just partly, that was something that I was told, right? Huh. When I was a young poet, and you may know that I have a fairly discursive and digressive imagination, right? That I like to gather, and I like to put things together next to each other. And when I was quite a young poet, that was not the dominant mode, at least not where I was studying. And people were constantly telling me, cut this out of the poem, cut this out of the poem. It doesn't really relate. And so I was a little bit older before I realized that my real job, it was actually probably the last poem that I wrote for my first collection, when I thought, you know, my real job here is not to make this poem about one thing. It's to accommodate all the different things that for me comprise the experience that I want to not only communicate in the poem, but actually enact for others and provide for readers in the poem. Because another shift that I think occurs when you move from being a younger poet to an older poet is that you realize that poetry is not actually about self-expression. This is what I have to try to teach my very young poets at the university. It's not about you. It's about the reader. Hmm. It's not about expressing or communicating something that's profound and unique from and about you. It's about creating the space for the reader to experience something profound and unique, which will be, by the way, a different experience than the one that the poem is coming out of for you as a writer. And one of the things that happens as you begin to work toward that second imagination of a poem is you really, that's very helpful in letting you let go of the one thingness or the idea that the reader's experience needs to be as close as possible to your experience. And that's a very freeing kind of moment when you think you're just giving the reader this space. And what the reader is going to do is come and play out elements of his or her own life, his or her own imagination, his or her own set of emotional needs at that place. And that the best poem that you can make is the one in which you are exercising enough control to make that a really complicated and resonant space, but not so much control that the reader loses his or her freedom in that encounter.
What was the poem that got you, I don't know if it was an epiphanal moment, but what was that poem that made you think that my job is not to just work toward one thing?
It's a poem in the first book called Sentimental. And it's a long poem. It's made up of sonnets linked by free verse sections. And it's really about this landscape and about growing up in the desert, but it's also about Italian art and Puti. It's about the nuclear tests that occurred when you and I were children here. And it's about being free on the landscape, right? All of these different things are coming together. And I had all my, you know, teachers sort of lined up on the windowsill, furrowing their brows at me, you know, and saying, you can't do all this. You can't have all this in a poem, all this, you know, playing with different forms and bringing in different things. And I would just look at them and I would say, that's the job, is to make that happen in the poem. And it's not a perfect poem, but it was maybe for me the moment when I really came into touch with how exciting writing poetry could be.
I think it's interesting also that you write about how over time that you no longer knew your own work, in the sense that you, when you would look at the page of a poem, you said that you would see these fragments, and it seemed as though you were looking at, well, this is how you put it, it seemed as though you were looking at the way your mind worked. Is that how your mind works? Do you see life? Do you sort of perceive it in fragments?
I think I often do perceive it in fragments. And I think I perceive it as, in a way, more complicated than those very intricately wrought poems that I made when I was younger. And this happened, I think, in part because I'd been working on my craft for a long time.
Yeah.
And therefore, there were certain things that I used to have to really think about doing in a poem that I didn't have to think about doing anymore. The craft was there and was sort of automatic. And I was also at a point when I was really busy. I was commuting back and forth to Chicago. I was teaching my students. I was involved in faculty governance of the university. I was doing a lot of stuff. And I started to have to find the kinds of spaces, to find spaces for writing poems that were not as precious as the spaces that I'd had before. So I used to think that I needed to have 3 hours before I could work on a poem. And it got to where 15 minutes in an airport waiting area, you know, was just going to have to do, or an hour on an airplane, or on a run, right? I learned that I could make a sonnet in my head while I was running. So I no longer, you know, was that person who had to have this incredibly intact and isolated and kind of precious space that where poetry, it was possible and necessary for poetry to be a part of the fabric of my life all the time. So the poems became available to me in a different kind of way. And one of the things that happened then was that I would have these pieces of poems that when I did have 2 hours or 3 hours to sit down, I would just go and, you know, go through the notes on my phone or the scraps of paper that I had accumulated and begin to figure out how they were talking to each other and how the fabric of an experience was getting built kind of across time and across across the life, right, as it was being lived. And this was a whole new way of working for me. And I wasn't even sure if what I was doing was productive or would be recognizable to other people as poetry. And to some of the people who had read me before, it really wasn't. They wanted me back, right, to the old way of working. But to other people, they found those poems, which again were poems I think that opened that kind of space for the reader that I was talking about before. They found them to be as exhilarating as I did.
That's Catherine Coles. She's Utah's former poet laureate, professor of English at the University of Utah. Her new book is The Stranger I Become, on walking, looking, and writing. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER's statewide service stays strong thanks to the listeners who also contribute to the station every month. Our nearly 9,000 sustaining members provide the most reliable source of income for the station, so we can bring you trustworthy news and information. If you value our commercial-free programming, consider becoming a KUER sustainer, with a recurring gift starting at just $5 a month, or increase your existing pledge. Just go to KUER.org/donate. And thanks for your support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the poet Catherine Coles is with us. We're talking about her latest book, a collection of lyric essays called The Stranger I Become. It's a meditation on walking and perception, and it's also really personal. She writes about the death of her father. She writes about finding her voice as a poet. And she writes about the boundary between what she thinks of as herself in her mind and the world out there.
Tell me the story when your husband asked you one morning, "How are you feeling?" And nothing came out, as you put it. What happened?
I think it just suddenly became clear to me what a complicated question that is.
Yeah. Like, what do you mean?
What do you mean? How am I feeling? And a lot of the time we just, that's one of those questions that we answer on autopilot, right? I'm fine. Yeah. I'm fine. Thank you. Right. How are you feeling? But it also became clear to me in that moment that the question came to me as a question about operation and operativeness, as in, how is it that you execute this thing that we call feeling, right? So not only does your head not hurt, right? Or, did you sleep well or whatever, but how is it that you engage with the world not only as a perceiving creature, but also as an emotional or a feeling creature? How are you constructing your emotional life? And maybe how are you constructing your life of physical pleasure or physical pain?
But you write in that section, a poem isn't emotion, it's words.
Yeah.
And this is, I have to say, it's a theme that seems to come out a few times, actually. We'll get back to another version of it here in a moment. But what do you mean it isn't emotion, it's words?
So this is my quarrel with Wordsworth, right?
That cold fish Wordsworth you describe him as, yes.
And Wordsworth, we'll just get it out of the way. He's a great poet. I recognize that, et cetera, et cetera. But I have a lot of quarrels with him. And he defines poetry as emotion recollected in tranquility. What he's talking about there, I think, is the feeling that he hopes that a poem will engage in him while he's writing it. And maybe, I don't think he cares all that much about readers, but will engage in the reader who's experiencing it ideally. But a poem is not emotion. I go to poems, as I think you can probably tell from this book, I go to poems in order to feel. But the poems don't, they're not just like zapping, what is it, the Vulcan mind meld? They're not zapping feeling from the poet Wordsworth or otherwise to me. They are this construction of words that create not feeling, but the possibility for feeling that the reader might be able to enact or engage in entering this thing that's constructed of words.
Compare Wordsworth then maybe to Dickinson.
Oh.
You describe Emily Dickinson as your perfect stranger. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of your connection to Dickinson? Because we see a lot of Dickinson in the essay collection.
Yeah. Dickinson was a poet that I came to very early, in that she was read to me as a child, presented to me in a way as a kind of children's poet. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul, right? That kind of thing. And I think that's wonderful that she's exposed to children, but I also think that that's part of what might cause us, or might have caused us for such a long time, to dismiss her as a poet of the incredible complexity and, let's face it, just wildness that she is. And so there was a long period of time in which I was a sort of official admirer of Dickinson, but not an avid reader of Dickinson. I think it was having memorized some of those poems as a child that brought her back to me. The fact that these poems lived inside of me and began to sort of reappear in my mind and my imagination, that sent me back to her. And by the way, I never took a class in which Dickinson was taught. She was seen as this sort of uptight, maiden, agoraphobic poet who was repressed, etc. And if you read the poems, you realize, oh my goodness, nobody was less repressed than Emily Dickinson. I mean, she is the full body poet of full body poets. And so it was coming back to her partly because these poems lived in me and I began to engage them and to think about them in a different kind of way. And then just reading her, and then from reading her, of course, I went to teaching her as my kind of go-to poet. And as the poet in which it's possible to think about the ways in which poems can be deceptive, or in which we can let our ideas about the poems or the poet blind us to what's actually happening in the poems. And so going back to her and just really, I kind of geek out a little bit on Dickinson in this book, because, you know, sometimes I read commas in Dickinson and say, look what she's doing with the punctuation here. And that's not actually about making the poems dry and unfeeling. It's about really thinking about where emotion, or the potential for emotion, is really inhabited in the poem through the words and the punctuation marks and the line breaks and the way she manages the language.
Well, we should explain, you transcribed Dickinson's poems directly from the handwritten manuscripts in the archive,
which are available to anyone online.
Yeah. So what is the difference that you're seeing between the handwritten manuscripts and you know, a sort of a printed version of it? What are you seeing in her poetry in that writing?
Well, you know, there's a kind of long history of Dickinson. And one thing to remember about her is that in the very early published poems, and only a very few were published during her lifetime because she put a lid on it really quickly. One of the reasons was the way in which print couldn't express the poems as she had imagined them on the pages. So when you go to the page, I mean, some of the poems are just, it's a matter of the ways in which her early editors would regularize her punctuation, which is never a good idea with Dickinson. But part of it is the way in which, for example, there are poems in which she'll give you the option for a particular word in the poem of choosing among maybe two words, three words, sometimes five words. She'll give you a little stack of words and you get to sort of shuttle through, and you might choose one, which is what her editors did, right? They had to do that. Or you might decide, as I think she did, to treat the poem as if all those words are operative at the same time. And she also has notes and indications on those poems where she might indicate a whole section and offer you a replacement section. And I think that she, again, is not asking you to choose one of those sections. She's asking you to accommodate the possibility that both of those sections are viable in the poem.
Does one come to mind, a Dickinson poem?
There is one Long Worlds Apart. It's one of the envelope poems. And this is a poem in which she both has a word stack and she has a section substitution. But the other thing that this poem does that's really phenomenal is that she actually uses the envelope and especially the back flap of the envelope to determine where the words are, where she's writing the words. And there's a moment where she refers to kindling that's right next to where the sealed flap is, and the flap is sealed with a depiction of a branch with leaves on it in a sort of circular wreath. And so you have this sense in which the poem, as it's thinking about kindling and about the starting of a fire, is engaging your visual imagination in imagining that that fire is starting right there on that branch where the envelope, which keeps the message secret, is sealed. It goes something like this. Long years apart can make no breach, a second cannot fill. The absence of a witch cannot invalidate the spell. The alternate, by the way, for that moment in the poem is, who says the absence of a witch invalidates his spell? The embers of a thousand years uncovered by the hand that fondled them when they were fire will gleam and understand. And the poem bends around the flap of the envelope with that little stamp of a piece of kindling right in that moment where she says that fondled them when they were fire.
Catherine Coles. Her new collection of essays is called The Stranger I Become, on walking, looking, and writing. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the poet Catherine Coles. We're talking about her new book, The Stranger I Become.
When did you first shave your head?
I shaved my head as a gesture of freedom when I ended a romance that I think both the man and I had thought would probably lead to marriage, except that when he proposed, I said, yes, but we can't tell anybody for a week. And then after a week, said no. And something that happened in that relationship was that even though he fell in love with me by sight when I had quite short hair, though not shaved, he was constantly pushing me to grow my hair. And so when I left that relationship, I went to my hairdresser. And in fact, my long-term time hairdresser wouldn't shave it. I had to go to somebody else. And it wasn't shaved. It was like maybe, you know, a half an inch long. Wasn't quite shaved. But I had to go to somebody else to get that person to do it. And then I actually really never looked back. Huh.
There's an essay where it's kind of a disquisition on hair in some ways. And I wanted to ask you about it. You mentioned a friend of yours who you came to know later, who only knew you with your hair as it is now. And they were looking at these old photos, and she asks, or maybe he, why you cut it. And in the book, you write this, you write about that question. Is she sentimental for something she never saw, for lightness, for deception? Talk about that.
So this is a friend. It is a she who has a very different relationship with her hair than I have with mine. And her hair gives her pleasure. And my hair, when I had hair, was really, and I think this is true for a lot of women, it was really about the pleasure of others. And for me, my hair was a trial to me. It literally hurt me physically because I have a lot of cowlicks. But it was unmanageable, and it was very blonde. You wouldn't know that now. But it got a lot of attention for that. People would stop me on the street after I shaved my head too and ask me about it. But people would stop me on the street and ask me what I did to my hair to make it that color, to make it shine the way that it did, et cetera. It was a distraction to me. And I think in that same essay, I say, anyone who thinks I'm not vain hasn't been paying attention. But my hair, it wasn't a vanity for me. It was just a constant trial. And there was much more vanity, I think, involved in actually cropping it as closely as I do than there was in keeping it the way that it was.
Would you read a section? It's the last sequence of the essay, begins "My father's hair." And could you read right to the bottom of the essay?
"My father's hair, still thick, is more steel than pepper. In my age, I would rather have my mother's, which glances and shines pure platinum, as I once had and abandoned her polished goldenness in my golden youth. She dyed her hair for years before succumbing to its emergent beauty. I hope I have a brain that stays like hers, mostly intact, though at almost 60, I already feel how the world recedes. I ask my canny friend, does your hair not hurt you? Is it not a burden? She has taken scissors to it at her bathroom sink, leaving behind enough for a handhold. He hasn't spoken more than one word at a time for over a year. Today, as he's never done, my father lifts both hands toward my just shorn skull. I bend my head into his palms, where he holds it, touching lightly. It was years before I noticed the comb still in the bottom of my travel bag, in case of what, and removed it.
You write about the last days of your father.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about this section about objects of affection, as you put it. And you gather in your father's room in those last days. You brought food and you brought wine and you told stories around the bed. And you say that, this is what you write, you were not holding him here, but weaving him back into time.
That was an incredibly precious few days when the hospice nurse told us that she thought we had 24 to 48 hours by her judgment. And he actually gave us almost twice that time. And sort of moving into and out of the room and telling those stories and really trying to, there was no reminding him at that point, but we were reminding ourselves, right, of him and who and what he'd been to us. And he was just a lovely, lovely man, deeply beloved by a lot of people, a brilliant, brilliant mathematician, and a wonderful father. And having that time to tell those stories of him. And by the way, I, of course, wrote the obituary because it, you know, just was the job that fell to me. But I pulled from those stories that we were telling in that room for the obituary, which I think was a somewhat unconventional piece of work. That, you know, there was no recovering him. There was no keeping him here. There was only, in a way, narrating him both into our own memories more firmly and also narrating him out of his life and into whatever it is that he was becoming.
There's a part of the essay where you write about the object that he left.
I had no use for my father's hunting rifles or place for the excellent canoe my mother bought him one birthday. His little bits of jewelry and cashmere sweaters, which, like his best wines he saved for festive occasions, went to my brothers, the cellar to my mother, who shares it with her children a few bottles at a time. In truth, my father never collected ornaments and baubles, though I happily wear my great-grandmother's passed-down jewels with jeans and flannel, as if they're meant for real life. He, too, liked things he could use, bungee cords, his instruments, good knives, cameras and binoculars, trucks with the power to uproot mature trees, the Moho Pizza ball cap my older brother brought him from Phoenix, or the one I carried back from Palmer Station in Antarctica, which let him bear an applique of a frozen continent like a hood ornament on his forehead. A fan of magpies, a depression baby, my father repurposed yogurt containers and collected used twist ties, tinfoil re-smoothed and folded away in a drawer. He might say of a paper sack that looked binnable, but whose structural integrity he'd assessed at a touch, "That's a really good bag." When his children made fun of him, he would say, wearing his serious face over his satirical one, "In the next war, you'll come begging for rubber bands." If you really get down to the disaster, the slightest eloquence becomes unbearable, Beckett says. The next war, or something like it, has arrived and keeps arriving. His rubber bands are gone.
You write this in reference to a Dickinson poem, that the objects are everything, and like so many things, they're also beside the point.
You know, we surround ourselves with objects. We're like magpies, I guess, in that way. We're distracted by the shiny and also by the useful. And yet we pass through and objects become, I mean, really the act of dying, right, is the act. It's the passage from the place in which objects are meaningful to us into the place in which they are completely irrelevant. And yet the objects that we've left behind become talismans for the people that we've left behind as well.
During the pandemic, you mentioned how the English poet Paul Munden tagged you. He was asking friends to post these images of the places where they were all pent up, you know, during the pandemic. But it also came to include the things, you know, the objects that they had with them. Could you talk a little bit about the object you chose? You chose a sea fan and a glass sculpture, among other things.
Yeah. And so what he wanted us to do was, for 10 days, he wanted us to post pictures of where we are.
Yeah.
And, that becomes complicated because one of the things it means is with what, right? Or are you in those places? How do you construct for other people? And this is like making art, right? A meaningful space that communicates something about how we are as fellow humans, weathering this isolation and accommodating ourselves to the isolation. And I mentioned at the beginning of this interview that I live essentially in a glass shoebox. And so for me, this it became really complicated to construct photographs that weren't as much exterior as interior. And so some of my shots are very tightly focused on a sea fan or a glass sculpture. And some of them are really intentionally using the outside world, or if they're being shot when it's dark outside, the reflections of what we can see in the room coming to us, not through the window, but reflected from the window.
How do you think this pandemic will change us? I know that seems like a simple question and a silly one in some ways, like how is it going to change us? Well, it changes us and it doesn't change us. But how are you thinking about the insights that you came to having been penned up and now anticipating venturing out again into the world? Like, how are you thinking about what changed, maybe in your point of view or whatever?
I do think that it gave us the opportunity for introspection and for really thinking about the society that we live in. So one of the things that was really laid bare, I think, by the pandemic is socioeconomic difference, questions of privilege. And these, and I'm talking about privilege both in the economic sense, but also racial privilege, gender privilege, et cetera. And, you know, I hope that for those of us who had the immense privilege of retreating to our homes and continuing to do our jobs, although through unfamiliar means, and I completely rethought my teaching in ways that will move forward with me once I'm teaching, as I think I will be in the fall in person. But those of us who had the privilege of maintaining our privilege, our immense privilege through all of this, and coming to understand the extent to which our privilege literally weighs on the backs and shoulders and labor of people who are most of the time invisible to us, separated from us by our front doors as they're bringing our groceries to us or right whatever it is that we're asking them to do. We talk about essential workers. So my big question, and I don't have an answer for this, is are we actually going to reconfigure our society, at least to some extent, to recognize the language that came to us to talk about the people who do the really essential work of our society and to figure out how to reward them adequately for that work and to honor them for that work?
There's this moment in the first essay where you write about how nature just recreates life again and again by kind of reshuttling the same old genes into these new combinations. And you write about how the possibilities, I guess, the possibilities, the choice in that sense then plays out infinitely. Would you say something about that idea of choice?
So of course genetically, that's however we might like to think that we're very mindful about how we pass on our genes, right? Genetically, that's actually really a pretty mindless choice. A lot of that, right, is about chance and how chance plays out. There's another essay in the book that is really about climate change and about the possibility of massive climate collapse and massive extinction events, which it's not just that we're on the edge of it, we're actually seeing this happening right now. And the ways in which for us as meaning-making creatures, that's incredibly terrifying and meaningful, especially since if all if the climate collapses, and if most of the species that we really love go extinct, there's a really good chance that we're going to go extinct with them. But the other thing that the essay considers is because of this incredible variability, et cetera, is that the Earth will not end. The Earth as we know it will end. Life on Earth will not end. The species that we have co-evolved with and come to love so much because of that co-evolution will end. What comes after us may not be the thing that we love, but to me, the possibility for love and for species that love and appreciate each other remains.
Catherine Coles, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Catherine Coles, her new book is The Stranger I Become, on walking, looking, and writing. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.